Good morning, historians. Welcome back to the Old History Podcast, where the goal is to just talk about history. Maybe you'll learn a thing or two. So, I've been kind of busy this week with helping the owner of Hayslope clean out the house. In the process, we've done some exploring, found some of the original logs, trying to uncover what exactly sort of modifications they made to the original cabin. And so far, what we can find is that on the second floor, at some point, they took the original roof off of the cabin and raised it up about another 2 or 3 feet on top of raising the original floor. So it's super weird the way it worked out, but I don't know. We're going to have to get an architectural historian out there to decipher some of this nonsense. It's honestly pretty confusing. There's like an extra 2 foot of floor added in some spots. All kinds of just weird stuff. But nonetheless, we're making progress at the house, and it is super exciting. So we'll take us a quick break here. But first, you can subscribe to the podcast if you want. It helps me out. It's not required to listen at all, but it just helps out. Thank you for those of you who are subscribed. So let's take a quick break here and we'll get into some more Civil War talk. All right, so this podcast might be a little short because I'm running out of time. I'm recording it late. So we'll talk about Jefferson Davis, the first and only president of the Confederate States of America. And so the sources for today are nps.gov and battlefields.org. Full credits to whoever wrote these articles. And so I want to go over the life of Jefferson Davis because he's an interesting feller, no matter which way you look at it. So he was a planter, politician, and soldier, born in Kentucky, raised in Mississippi. He was the 10th and youngest child of Revolutionary War soldier Samuel Davis and his wife Jane Cook Davis. His middle name was Finis, which in Latin means final, as the couple wanted no more children after Jefferson. He was born June 3rd, 1808, and was heavily influenced by his older brother, Joseph, who saw to it that he was well educated. He attended college in Kentucky at Transylvania before entering the U.S. Military Academy at West Point in 1824. As a young military cadet, his performance was only adequate, and when he graduated in 1828, he placed 23rd in a class of 24. He went on to serve briefly in the Black Hawk War of 1832 while stationed under Colonel Zachary Taylor, who would be the future president, by the way. The following year, he met the colonel's daughter, Sarah. Jefferson Davis married her in 1835 against her father's wishes. Sadly, the couple came down with bad cases of malaria only 3 months after the wedding, and the young bride would pass away. He would live a pretty secluded life for the next 8 years on his cotton plantation at Davis Bend, Mississippi. As a slaveholder, he firmly believed in the importance of the institution of slavery for the South. In 1845, he married his second wife, Verena Howell, a young woman who was 18 years old. Jefferson and Verena eventually would go on to have 6 children, 2 girls, 4 boys, but only their daughters lived into adulthood. In the same year, 1845, Mississippi sent Davis to the U.S. House of Representatives. His congressional term was short, however, he resigned in June 1846 to fight the Mexican War, where he led his troops at the battles of Monterey and Buena Vista. He was offered a promotion to Brigadier General in 1847, but refused it when he was elected to the U.S. Senate. In 1853, when President Franklin Pierce appointed Davis as the U.S. Secretary of War, where he served with distinction and was recognized as one of the most capable administrators to hold the office, and currently still is. In 1857, he returned to the Senate as a vocal proponent of states' rights, He formally withdrew from the U.S. Senate on January 21, 1861, after Mississippi seceded from the Union. 1 month later, the Confederate Congress in Montgomery, Alabama, selected Jefferson Phinis Davis to become the provisional president of the Confederacy. He was inaugurated for a six-year term as president on February 22nd of the following year. His appointment was largely political, but he was a compromise candidate chosen to appease both the moderate and radical factions in the Confederate Congress. Davis didn't really want the job, and he had hoped for a military command, as he was a very capable military leader, as was proven several times over the years of his career. Initially, he was a popular president with the Southern people. He had a dignified bearing, a distinguished military record, extensive experience in political affairs, and most importantly, a dedication to the Confederate cause. Unfortunately for Davis, these attributes would not be enough to triumph over the harsh challenges posed by his new position. His early popularity was a result of war fever, and he did not have the personality necessary to sustain it. He was impatient with people who disagreed with him, and he had the unfortunate habit of awarding proponent posts to leaders who appeared unsuccessful. Davis' loyalty to these people led to bickering and quarrels throughout his administration. In addition, he was plagued by chronic illness. His popularity and effectiveness were not enhanced by the growing numbers of Confederate defeats in the latter years of the war. On April 2, 1865, he and the other members of the Confederate government were forced to flee from Richmond before the advancing Union army. The Confederate president was captured by Northern soldiers near Irwinville, Georgia, on May the 10th, 1865. He was imprisoned at Fort Monroe, Virginia for 2 years, but he was never tried for treason. He was released on a bond in May 1867, and after being released, Davis and his family traveled for some time in Europe before returning to the American South. They first took up residence in Tennessee, but then relocated to the Mississippi Gulf Coast, where Davis lived out his retirement years at an estate called Beauvoir near Biloxi, Mississippi. Mississippi tried to return him to the U.S. Senate, but he was not legally qualified to serve since he refused to request official pardon from the United States for his role in the Civil War. Like many others, Davis would write about his wartime experiences, entitled The Rise and Fall of the Confederate Government, Volumes 1 and 2, which was published in 1881. He died in New Orleans, Louisiana, December 6, 1889, and the year before his death, the former president of the CSA beseeched the young men of Mississippi to lay aside all rancor and all bitter sectional feeling, to make your places in the ranks of those who will bring about a consummation devoutly to be wished, a reunited country. And we'll take a quick break here, and then we'll get into the Battle of Shiloh. So before we get in to the Battle of Shiloh, I would like to talk briefly about the Shelton Laurel Massacre, something that was brought up to me by somebody who listens to the podcast. They were asking me a bunch of questions about how they have a project they want to do with it, and they're asking me some questions, and I'm gladly obliged. So I'll just briefly go into this, just a little bit. So this wasn't really the only incident that ever happened like this, but it was a very, very, very common practice in terms of war, like when you get into bushwhackers and bridge burners and all that stuff. You know, basically guerrilla warfare. The Shelton Laurel Massacre of Madison County, North Carolina, proved to several historians that guerrilla warfare blurred the lines between combatants and non-combatants and obscured the rules of war, and also revealed that Confederate sympathizers were as willing as Union sympathizers to be bushwhackers and redefine mountain warfare. Unionists and Confederates lived in the Madison County, North Carolina area, and allegiances would change many times. depending on the prevailing military presence in the area. Many times, familial allegiances and long-standing grudges heightened the tensions between Confederates and Unionists, and may have been the predominant factor in precipitating much of the violence. There are four major figures involved in the Shelton Laurel Massacre. John Kirk, who was a Union raider, he fled to Madison County to escape pursuing Confederates and led a band of about 50 Union sympathizers and deserters. Confederate General Henry Heath, commander of the Department of East Tennessee, who ordered Lawrence Allen and James Keith to subdue the Kirk raiders and prevent more vandalism and looting. Colonel Lawrence Allen, a Marshall resident and leader of the 64th North Carolina, who had a personal interest in stopping Kirk's lawlessness. James Keith, second in command of the 64th North Carolina, and the one who ordered 13 executions. Frustrated that Union guerrillas and deserters had attacked their hometown and communities, Allen's wife and three sick children were harassed. Allen and Keith responded, and under Heath's orders, they were to crush the perpetrators and ensue Confederate rule and order. It began on January 1863 when the guerrillas under Kirk's leadership raided the town of Marshall in search of foodstuffs, salt, and ammunition and other stuff to survive the bitter mountain winter months. Approaching Laurel Valley, Keith and Allen's men searched anxiously for those involved in the salt raid and arrested 15 along the way, no doubt thinking they were being transported back to Knoxville, Tennessee as prisoners of war. The 15 prisoners were reminded differently. Two seized the opportunity to escape on the march. Eventually, the remaining 13 were told to kneel in rows of 3 to 5 and summarily shot. Two had escaped, and all of the executed were related to each other, and many shared the same surname, which would be Shelton. The next day, members of the Shelton family would discover their relatives' partially buried bodies. The Confederate officials were infuriated at the 64th's actions, and officials wanted the Unionists defeated and justice implemented, but they warned the pursuers to separate personal animosities from mission objectives. Zebulon Vance was especially appalled. He demanded an investigation into the horrible incident. Keith was later court-martialed, resigned, and returned home to Madison County. Allen would only be suspended from active duty for 6 months. This is from NorthCarolinaHistory.org. Source: John Isco and Gordon B. McKinney, Heart of the Confederate Appalachia, Western North Carolina in the Civil War, Chapel Hill, 2000. And so that's for the person who messaged me. That's just a little bit about it. This information is everywhere. Now, I'm not too up to date on my North Carolina Civil War stuff, but thank you for the message and bringing this up. This is an interesting thing, but another in a long line of guerrilla warfare tactics that happened over the course of the war. And even a little bit after, as hostilities kept going. All right, so the Battle of Shiloh, April 6th and 7th, 1862, which is also known as the Battle of Pittsburgh Landing. This basically allowed Union troops to shove right through the Confederate interior, and the carnage here was unprecedented. The death toll here was the greatest of any war on the American continent up to that date. So, to consolidate his forces and prepare against Grant, Johnston marshals his forces at Corinth. The Confederate retreat is welcomed by Grant, whose Army of the Tennessee needs time to prepare for its own offensive on up the Tennessee River. Grant's army camps at Pittsburgh Landing, where it spends time drilling recruits and awaiting Major General Don Buell's Army of Ohio. Grant is ordered not to engage the Confederates until he has been reinforced by Buell's army, which is marching overland from Nashville to meet him. Once combined, the two armies will advance south of Corinth. Anticipating a move against Corinth, Johnson and his men, a 44,000 man army of Mississippi, plan to smash Grant's army at Pittsburgh Landing before Buell can arrive with more Union troops. And on April 3rd, Johnston places his troops in motion, but it rains pretty heavily, and that delays his attack. By nightfall on April 5th, his army is deployed for battle, only 4 miles southwest of Pittsburgh Landing. Pickets from both sides nervously exchange gunfire in the dense woods that evening. So, April the 6th, and I should note that 110,000 total troops were engaged here. Probably one of the greatest numbers up until that point of troops engaged. 65,000 Union to 44,000, almost 45,000 Confederate. So April 6th at daybreak, three corps of Confederate infantry storm out of the woods and sweep onto the southernmost Federal camps, catching Grant's men unprepared. Intense fighting centers around Shiloh Church as the Confederates sweep the Union line from that area. Despite heavy fire on their position, Union troops continue to counterattack, but slowly lose ground and fall back northeast towards Pittsburgh Landing. Throughout the morning, Confederate brigades force Grant's troop into defensive positions at Shiloh Church. The Peach Orchard, Water Oaks Pond, and a treacherous thickets of oaks named Hornet's Nest by fortunate survivors. That afternoon, while leading an attack on the left into the Union's Hornet's Nest line, Johnston is shot in the right knee. The bullet severs an artery and the commander bleeds to death. General Pierre G.T. Beauregard is appointed the new Confederate commander. Believing his army victorious, Beauregard calls a halt to the attacks as darkness approaches. Now, he is unaware that overnight Buell arrives with reinforcements for Grant. The Union Army now has almost 54,000 men near Pittsburgh Landing and outnumbers Beauregard's army of around 30,000 pretty heavily. Grant's army launches their attack at 6 a.m., and Beauregard immediately orders a counterattack. The Confederates are ultimately compelled to fall back and regroup along their line, and Beauregard orders a second counterattack, which halts the Federals' advance, but ultimately ends in a stalemate. The Timberclads, USS Tyler, and the Lexington provides naval artillery support to Grant's left flank from the Tennessee River. At about 3 p.m. that evening, Beauregard realizes he is outnumbered and, having already suffered tremendous casualties, retreats towards Corinth. So, I'll go on to say here, there's 23,746 total casualties, 13,000 of those being Union and 10,000 of those being Confederate. So there were 1,700 killed on both sides, 8,000 wounded on both sides, and as far as the Union, they had almost 3,000 missing, as opposed to the Confederate having only 959 missing. So on April 8th, Grant dispatches Brigadier General William Tecumseh Sherman and Brigadier General Thomas Wood to ascertain Confederate's position. Oh, somebody tried to call me. At Fallen Timber, six miles south of the battlefield, they encounter rebel cavalry under Nathan Bedford Forrest. Forrest charges onto the Federals ahead of his own troops and is shot by Federal infantry at point-blank range, although he will later require difficult surgery to remove the life-threatening bullet. Forrest's reckless aggression pays off. Federal forces flee in the direction of Pittsburgh Landing, allowing the Confederates to escape. The loss of life on both sides at Shiloh, which ironically means place of peace in Hebrew, was staggering. But there were other sad consequences of the battle as well. Johnston's death was a damaging blow to Confederate morale, and particularly for President Jefferson Davis, who held Johnston in high personal and professional esteem. Grant, though victorious, was vilified in the press after being caught unprepared at Pittsburgh Landing on April 6th. Critics called him to be dismissed, but Abraham Lincoln defended his general, declaring, "I can't spare this man. He fights." Corinth fell to the Union by the end of May, allowing Grant to focus on gaining control of the Mississippi River. So that's all for today, folks. Thanks for listening. As always, you can subscribe to the podcast. See you guys next time.